already aware that something substantial happened last night. An hour later, we sit in a circle on the floor of the vaulted room. The jungle around us is fully awake, humming, buzzing, and chirping in through the thin screened walls. Many of you already heard some news of what happened last night, I begin. But I wanted to gather you here so we could discuss it openly. For those of you who don't already know, I choke up, unexpectedly, as the words fail to form in my throat. Surprised and eerily fascinated by my floundering attempt to speak to the group, I try again. Last night, Gary passed away. My eyes move involuntarily to the floor as I try to hold it together. Why wasn't it this hard last night? And then the realization comes. I feel like I let them all down. I don't want them to second-guess their decision to come here. I don't want them to stop believing in the healing path. He was so happy here. Gretchen breaks the silence with a big smile as she speaks. None of this got to him one bit. The man was made to be in the woods. Jessica chimes in. We bumped into each other on the trail the other day, and he was radiating. He wasn't in any pain. He was feeling so good this past week. He told me all about the natural tendencies of one of the bees that we saw in a flower, and then we said goodbye. The patients are all beaming and nodding in agreement as they share their final words about Gary, one by one. This is not what I was expecting, and it has me dumbfounded. I'm happy for him, because I know how he must have felt coming here. This opportunity showed up and gave him some hope, but he knew it was going to be a long shot. Melinda's words come out wistfully. A fellow cancer patient, she is obviously sobered by the news, but her voice holds a deep reverence. John, who just days ago yelled at one of the shamans for not letting him eat fruit for breakfast, speaks last. He really loved it out here. He had nothing but positive things to say about everything and everyone here. I think he really had a chance to work through what he needed to work through in order to make the transition peacefully. After all I've spoken, I realize that I've underestimated these people who put so much faith in us. They might be struggling with an illness, but they are far from frail. These are some of the toughest individuals I've ever met. Most folks wouldn't want to brave the unknowns of this final jungle frontier in perfect health. The human beings sitting in front of me, and Gary as well, were willing to come all this way in a weakened state, knowing that it would be one of the hardest experiences of their lives. Somehow, in focusing on their weaknesses, I failed to fully acknowledge their strength. I promise myself it won't happen again. Are we still going to be having the group meditation tonight and a San Pedro ceremony tomorrow? It is Gretchen who asks, but everyone looks at me as if they have been wondering the same thing. Coming into this room, I assume that at least a few of the patients would want to go home immediately upon hearing the news of Gary. I was planning on opening that door to them and making arrangements for those who took me up on it. Now I see that this is the last thing that any of them are thinking about. Put your game face on, Nick. Absolutely. Group meditation tonight. And Roman will be back in the morning to begin preparing the maloca for San Pedro. I stand up and walk to each patient to check in individually for a moment. Hugs are exchanged, and then the meeting is adjourned. Heartened and a little shaken, I head back to the longhouse to make the dreaded call via satellite phone to Gary's emergency contact back in the States, his sister Susan. There are moments in your life when you are stepping into such uncharted territory that you have no choice but to blindly stumble forward, suspending all inner dialogue. There is no right way to call a woman and tell her that her brother is dead. You just punch the numbers into the phone and let it unfold, 1 second at a time. Gary had told me that his sister thought he was crazy to come down here in his condition, and that they had had it out before he left. Don't think. Just enter the numbers. The standard ringing sound that you hear after dialing a number varies from country to country. Up in the States, it's a series of single-spaced rings. But in Peru, it's a pair of droning beeps followed by a long silence.
Beep, 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 beep.
Hello, Nick. The voice on the other end is clearly that of a woman, and her first two words are almost giggled rather than spoken. Do I have the right person? And how does she know it's me? Yes. Is this Susan? Yes, it is. Her voice quivers. Is my brother dead? Tears flood my eyes for the first time since Gary left us, and I can't speak for a second. Sobbing, I garble into the speaker. Yes, he is. I'm sorry, Susan. She laughs a hearty laugh this time, now crying too. Are you kidding me? He knew he had to be down there with you as soon as you walked into his house in Garibaldi a few months ago. He couldn't stop talking about you and the shamans, Nick this and Roman that. He didn't want you to know it, but his condition worsened quickly in the month between your interview with him in Oregon and his trip down to the jungle. The doctors told him he only had a week to live the day before he left. Susan's voice gets steadier as she goes on. I told him not to go, that he should be here with his family when he passed. But my brother has been an outdoorsman his entire life. He wanted one last adventure. He'd never been to the Amazon before and really believed this was his last chance at getting better. He and I said goodbye before he left. I think we both knew it would be the last time I saw him. Wait a second, I begin, not quite processing all I've just heard. Gary never told us any of this. He had less than a week to live? Yeah, he didn't want you to know. He thought you might not let him come, but he barely made it onto his plane because he needed so much assistance. Assistance? He was walking up and down the trails for the past week with no problem, I tell her. He said he couldn't feel the tumors in his belly anymore, and he thought they were gone. I can't believe he never told me. She pauses for a moment, then says, more seriously, There's much about Gary that nobody knows. The waters ran deep with that one. After a moment, she goes on, Remember this. My brother wanted to be with you. He knew it was probably going to be his final few days of life, and he wanted to be down there with you and Roman. It sounds like he made the right choice. The sun begins to slide below the forest canopy a few hours later. I'm sitting on the front steps of Hut 6 with Habin, who felt it would be a good idea to return to Gary's place and perform a smoke clearing. Sometimes a soul needs a little help to make the full transition. Let's ensure that Gary made a clean exit, Habin says as he lights a stick of Palo Santo. I'll be back out in a few minutes. The Coca Shaman enters the hut, barefoot, and stands in silence in the darkness of the 10-by-10-foot space for a good 2 minutes before making his way over to Gary's bed. He pulls up the mosquito net, holds the Palo Santo over the mattress, and begins to say a quiet prayer in Spanish. He then moves the smoldering incense over each surface in the room, watching the play of the smoke as he goes. His hand guides the tendrils into the seemingly empty pockets of air above the small table in the corner, then over the space on the floor where Gary's body lay last night. 15 minutes later, Habin opens the screen door and sits down next to me on the steps. In the fading light, he opens his pouch, withdraws 3 coca leaves, arranges them into a Kintu triad between forefinger and thumb, and says a small blessing. He bites into them, leaving only the stems in his fingertips, looks up at the sky, and begins to speak. What is death? What is life? Life without death has no meaning. Life doesn't exist without death. Wherever there is life, there is death, and we cannot hide from it. Death is a change, a process that is necessary for life. Those who live in the Western world have demonized it, out of fear and ignorance. They believe there is something to be afraid of after death. But what is it? What is God? He is life itself. So they stay away from death, and by doing so, they also stay away from life. Habin draws 3 more coca leaves from his pouch, arranging them shiny side up, with stems pointing toward the ground. He studies them for a good minute, and finally lets out a long breath through his nostrils. It is done. He is no longer here. Perhaps the reason that shamanism and indigenous medicine are spreading so quickly nowadays is because they hold basic primal truths that resonate within all of us. The most powerful of these being the understanding that neither life nor death should be feared. One thing we are guaranteed in this life is that there will be an end to our physical incarnation. Surrender is the only way forward. Surrender to the impermanence of this body. The impermanence of this emotion we are feeling right now. And the impermanence of any challenge we will ever face. Chapter 9. Relampago. Thunder is good. Thunder is impressive. But it is lightning that does the work. Mark Twain. November 4th, 2010. Loreto Province, Peru. It's around 9 p.m. and the team and I are wrapping up for the night. We're at the end of the third week of filming. The patients are going through plenty of breakdowns and breakthroughs, but morale is high. Gary's passing has galvanized the group, boosting determination and sense of purpose in both patients and healers. It's been raining since sunrise, and we're busy cleaning gear, backing up footage, and planning for the following day. This has become our nightly ritual, a way to stay sharp and connect with one another before bed. In an environment like this, adhering to certain protocols during downtime helps to settle the mind and at least give the illusion of control over the highly unpredictable circumstances. I'm peering over Brock's shoulder at a video clip he's analyzing when the walkie-talkie bleeps on. Nick, please come to the Maloka. It's very important. Every one of us has grown wary of the abruptness of that device, especially at this hour of the night. We sit in silence for a few moments, the tip-tap of falling droplets of water on the thatch roof overhead and wet breeze blowing in through the thin floor-to-ceiling screens of our longhouse tell me that I'm about to get wet. The rainy season is upon us, and the Maloka is about a quarter mile deeper into the jungle. I look over at Dan, who has resumed making notes in a Moleskine booklet, and he gives me a, who knows, shrug. Don't wait up for me, I say. I put on a poncho and walk down the creaky wooden steps to the cement slab foundation below. On go the oversized rubber mud boots, and out I walk into the night. These rare moments away from the team, between one task and the next, have become vital for me. As I'm trudging along in the darkness through mud and plant life, my mind can turn off for a short while. There are no fires to put out, no decisions to be made, just me and the forest. We've been wet for a week now, so a little extra water is an easy trade-off for some solitude. 15 minutes later, I'm splashing up an embankment and can now see the lights of the Maloka. It's by far the tallest man-made structure for miles, at a whopping 35 feet high, casting long beams of light through the trees like a jungle lighthouse. Somebody must be waiting for me up in the attic. The Maloka is a 2-level temple that is customary to most tribes in this neck of the jungle. The bottom level has no windows, and the floor is fine white sand. This is where the ayahuasca ceremonies are held. The top level, or attic, of this particular structure is walled on all sides by windows with thin green screens, and its vaulted ceiling stretches up to the rafters and circular thatched roof above. When candles are lit on the top floor at night, the octagonal structure turns into a towering lantern. And so it is as I approach, unsure of who or what is awaiting me. I walk up the hand-hewn side steps that wrap around the building and peer through the screen door that is latched shut on the landing. I see the silhouettes of 3 people huddled around some candles inside. I remove my boots and open the door. "Good evening, brother," Roman says as I enter. "Sorry to make you walk all the way out here in the rain, but the three of us are about to have a coca ceremony, and we thought it would be good for you to join." As I come closer, I see that the other two silhouettes belong to Edwin and Habin, the mysterious shaman who seems to be revealing more of his supernatural skills with each passing day. Rumor has it that as a young man, Habin wandered into Manu National Park, a large stretch of the Amazon wilderness and home to some of the last uncontacted tribes, and wasn't seen or heard from for 10 years. He emerged in his mid-30s with some serious healing knowledge, among other things, and now works primarily with coca and mapacho, Amazonian tobacco. Habin's demeanor is grave as he stares at me in the candlelight. "Have you ever sat in a coca ceremony before?" His Spanish is rapid, and his accent is totally different from what I'm used to, but his question is clear enough. "No," I answer. "This will be my first. But I've been chewing a lot of coca during the day while we work," I add, trying to be helpful. "A coca ceremony is an entirely different thing. With a proper ceremony, this plant will show you an entirely different side of itself. We sit, we chew, we smoke mapacho, and we share stories of who we are and how we came to be. Make no mistake, this isn't a time for idle chatter. We share from our hearts. Otherwise, we listen." I'm beginning to lose track of him. My Spanish is serviceable when it comes to one-on-one communication where the speaker slows down to accommodate my language gap. But a more rapid exchange like this one is beyond my ability. Seeing my poorly disguised confusion, Habin glances at Roman, then back at me. The two exchange some quick remarks in abbreviated slang about the current stage I'm at with the local dialect. Habin motions toward an open patch of floor, indicating that I should park myself there. "Don't worry about it," I tell myself. "Just relax and make yourself comfortable. We're apparently going to be here for a while." The coca shaman digs into his satchel and pulls out a small mesa blanket that is intricately woven with multicolored fabric. Next, he produces a large bag from which he removes a generous handful of coca leaves, spreading them across the mesa while saying some quiet words to himself. He motions to Roman, inviting him to partake first, a clear sign of respect for the other shaman, and then Edwin, who gently selects a few leaves with the discernment of a collector examining stamps or coins. And finally, I am invited in. Ceremonies like this can last for 5 or 6 hours, depending on the occasion and the shaman who is holding them. The first 10 or so leaves that we pack into our mouths will be followed by hundreds more before the night is over. "Halpi aikusinchis," Habin says to the three of us, as he blows on the 3 perfectly formed leaves positioned between his thumb and index finger. Closing his eyes, he says a few more words under his breath before biting the leaves off so that only the stems remain. Chew, chew, chew. Once the leaves are pulverized by your teeth, you maneuver them with your tongue over to the side of your mouth between molars and cheek. That's where the leaves stay, as you pack more in and let the enzymes in your saliva extract the active constituents from them. "Edwin, tell us a story about yourself." Habin speaks through a mouthful of coca as he continues to select more leaves from the pile and pack them in. "About me? Well, the story of how I met Roman is pretty interesting, right, Roman?" Roman nods, and Edwin begins to tell us of his first encounter with the shaman and how unlikely it was that their paths should cross. As usual, I'm fully able to understand the conversation until Edwin begins to share some intricate emotions regarding his upbringing, the way his mother treated him growing up, and some conflicts he still had with his brother. I know I'm completely lost when he pauses and makes a parenthetical comment that must hold some scandalous backstory, and the two other shamans interject their own remarks with lowered voices. Apparently Edwin's tale has reached some juicy climax that I am completely unaware of. Damn! I can't stand when this happens. One of the worst feelings in the world for a documentary filmmaker, and human being, is when a language barrier prevents you from participating or at least understanding an important conversation. These three invited me here to be part of a special council meeting of sorts, and here I am, clueless as to what is being discussed. I sit, nodding falsely at them while they speak, while I continue to stuff more and more coca into my cheeks, the only thing I can think to do to show my enthusiasm. After about 10 minutes of feeling like a buffoon, and wallowing silently and being on the outside of this intimate session, I decide I'm just going to give in to the experience and act the way I feel, rather than playing along. I lean back on my elbows, find a cushion under the window behind me, and lie down, staring at the web-like eaves above. The conversation pauses for a second while I do this, as the three obviously take note of my shift away from the group, but it starts right up again a moment later. The juices from the wad of coca begin to trickle down my throat as I listen to the infinite drops of rain exploding off the leaves, limbs, and mud outside. The bitter juice is beginning to numb my gums. The wind is starting to pick up in the surrounding forest, blowing wet air through the screen wall that separates us from the jungle. Something in the air is changing. I hear the faintest rumble underneath the pitter-patter and a rustle of wind through trees. And then another. I love storms. Another 15 minutes pass. My three companions continue their lively discussion, and I remain a satellite on the outskirts of the circle, but completely content to be. I can't tell if it's the coca or simply being in the presence of these shamans, but I am filled with a sort of electric giddiness, and the feeling is intensifying with every minute. A flash and crackle from above brightens the forest to the north of us for a few seconds. I've never seen lightning in the jungle before. Oceans of rain, yes, but never lightning. It's getting closer. Habin is now in the middle of recounting one of his long journeys up the Manu River, where he almost died of starvation after days of wandering through the jungle, lost and without supplies. His voice lowers as he speaks about a specific night when he thought all was lost as he huddled under a large lupuna tree on a riverbank for warmth. I was trying to will myself to sleep when I began to hear the most beautiful singing, carried on the breeze from upriver. I got up and began to stumble through the forest in the direction of this heavenly sound, seeing my way by the light of the moon. As I came around a bend in the bank, I saw before me something that still gives me chills to this day. A mermaid, una sirena, sitting right there on a rock in the middle of the river. A mermaid? Come on, really? Like a real one? Or a vision of a mermaid? Have either of you ever heard of anything like this? I speak out of turn, almost involuntarily. The locals tell tales about jungle mermaids, but I've never heard of an actual interaction with one. No, it was a real mermaid, my friend. Just ask the locals, even in this region. Foreigners think these stories are myth, but the native people know they are. Habin breaks off. Wait a second. Look who decided to join the conversation. Roman, Habin, and Edwin grin at me across the cluster of candles between us. What? Oh. Somehow the garbled code that the other three have been speaking is 85% comprehensible now. I've never been able to understand half of these words. Coca is very powerful that way. It opens up new pathways for communication, internally and externally. You are now experiencing its full effect. Rumble. Crack. While Habin is speaking, the forest lights up around us. A tree that couldn't be more than 100 yards away is hit by lightning and falls to the jungle floor with a loud thud. Our heads snap around, involuntarily, in the direction of the strike. That one was really close, Edwin observes. Roman's eyes are wide open. Not to worry. This maloca is only half the height of the trees outside. We are safe here. Habin turns and faces me square on. Now that we can understand one another, I'd like to hear more about who you are and what your intention is for this documentary that we all seem to be wrapped up in. Oh, this coca ceremony is really another shamanic test. Here goes. Well, I begin. I've been involved in 2 other films to date that follow patients who are trying to heal themselves using a specific natural method. While we were filming them, a few of our experts made mention of shamanism. I followed the breadcrumb trail, and that led me here. Seems logical enough to me, but Habin doesn't seem totally satisfied. I try again. My mission in this world, as I see it, is to show people that they are more powerful than they realize. So many folks are sick and looking for answers with only Western medicine to turn to, which is failing them miserably. I healed myself of chronic migraine headaches 5 years ago using natural medicine, and I'm on a quest of sorts to bring ancient healing methods to the people who need them most. That is all very interesting, but you wouldn't be sitting here with us right now just because of a natural healing quest. Habin glances at Roman, then back at me. His eyes move down to the pile of coca leaves on the mesa blanket in front of him and stop, and he stares at something in their configuration for about 30 seconds while we sit in silence. He nods, inhaling a deep breath through his nostrils, then exhales.
Bueno. Okay.
Nick, can you tell me of any significant life-changing events that occurred when you were 16?
16. That's random.
Well, actually, that was a pretty bad year in the life of Nick. All those car accidents and the other stuff. Well, I'm not sure if this is what you're referring to, but right after I got my driver's license, I got in 5 car accidents and 1 boat accident. I wasn't really hurt in any of them, but the boat accident involved a high-speed crash into and over a small island, and the police said it was a miracle that we survived. Roman chuckles, shaking his head.
They still let you have your license after the first 2 car accidents?
Remind me never to let you drive, hermano.
I haven't had a car accident since. Knock on wood.
Habin's voice cuts through the air. You're not telling us everything. What else happened to you in that year?
Jeez. What does this guy want from me?
I thought the car and boat accident thing was pretty substantial.
Let me think. It's such a long time ago, you know?
The rain is starting to pound on the roof of the Maloka. A loud rumble comes from somewhere above us.
Oh yeah, that.
But does that really count as substantial?
What is the word for lightning in Spanish again?
I ask Roman in English.
Relampago, he answers.
When Habin hears this word, the coca chewing stops and eyebrows rise. When I was 16, I might have been partially struck by lightning, I say hesitantly. I was standing outside during a storm for some reason, and, well, lightning split the tree next to me in half.
Relampago?
You're sure you understand the meaning of this word?
The coca shaman leans toward me as he inquires.
Yeah, lightning. Boom. From the sky. Electricity. Like the one that hit that tree a few minutes ago. I was really dumb to be outside that day. I could have died.
Habin turns to Roman. Did you know about this?
No. This is news to me as well.
Roman's eyes are a mystery as he responds to his friend.
Something serious is going on, but I have no idea what it is. In the Andes Mountains, an encounter with lightning is one of the most significant rites of passage on the shamanic path. Were you aware of this?
Habin has apparently extracted the tidbit he was looking for my teenage years.
Pretty impressive that he was able to pinpoint it with such accuracy just by looking at a few scattered leaves.
No, I didn't know that, I say, still wondering what's going on.
Habin goes on to explain that in the Andes, a Pampa Misayuk, or Highland Healer Priest, can only become an Alto Misayuk, the highest level of shaman, if chosen by Pachamama herself. The word Alto Misayuk means chosen by the beam in Quechua. He looks up into the rafters, toward the thunder rumbling in the sky above us.
This happened to you when you were 16, and you magically find yourself here with us. This is no coincidence. Please tell us more about your encounter with the Relampago.
Lightning is defined as 1. An abrupt, discontinuous natural electric discharge in the atmosphere. Or 2. A sudden, usually improbable, stroke of fortune. Have you ever done something that in retrospect turned out to be a really stupid idea?
Of course you have. You're a human being.
Well, I did something really dumb when I was 16 years old
that changed the course of my life forever. It was late afternoon in June of 1994, and I had just broken up with my high school sweetheart, which was a very big deal. Not only was she my first girlfriend, but she also single-handedly, through her own popularity, elevated me from a quiet nobody to a somewhat conversational somebody in the course of just 6 months. No small feat. But after a year and a half of young love, it just wasn't working out, and we decided, rather emotionally, to go our separate ways. On the official day of breakup, there was something very beautiful happening weather-wise. If you've lived in the northeastern United States, you're no stranger to the magnificent thunderstorms that roll in periodically throughout the summer, seemingly out of nowhere, darkening the skies on a hot and humid day. Towering cumulonimbus clouds close in upon one another, temporarily turning day into night, as drops of water descend from the heavens to meet rather abruptly with blistering hot pavement, scorched lawns, and the heads of disappointed golfers. It was that kind of afternoon, and this particular weather pattern mimicked my inner climate of heartbreak so closely that I felt compelled to walk outside in the middle of the torrential downpour that was raging outside my house. Moved by the appropriateness of it all, I went into my garage and grabbed my boombox radio, kind of a 1980s Run DMC knockoff, popped in a mixtape Kim had given me, and walked out with deeply satisfied dramatic flair into the quickly flooding driveway of my suburban home. The raindrops were huge and many and cold, but they felt good as they hit my head and shoulders and quickly drenched my shirt. The sky was rumbling overhead, the clouds morphing and undulating as they moved quickly by. Flashes of lightning danced along the ridges of trees that delineated our neighborhood from the next one over, each followed by a quick clap of thunder. When I was little, my father had taught me how to track the distance of a lightning bolt by counting the seconds between the flash in the clouds and the audible crack and rumble that came after. We'd sit for an hour at a time, watching the sky and tracking the storms, waiting for fire in the sky. I stood there in my driveway, just feet away from Tower Road, so named because it led to the highest point in town during one of the strongest thunderstorms we would have all year. I was about 15 feet from a very tall oak tree when the unthinkable happened. Well, thinkable to any rational person, but not thinkable to me at the time. Bang! I remember a blinding flash of white light that consumed everything in my field of vision. Perfectly timed with this whiteout was a deafening sound, like you would hear from the guns on a warship, but louder and more electric. If you've ever heard a high-voltage transformer explode, that's about the same noise. Now, I wish I could say that in those moments immediately following the lightning strike, I had some deeply meaningful spiritual experience of oneness or saw my grandmother, who had just passed, in a near-death vision. But I cannot. I do think I peed a little, but I was too drenched from the rain to know for sure. I must have been out for at least a few minutes. When I eventually came to, I was very wet, very cold, and had a splitting headache. The rain had lightened a bit. The black top around me was now covered in leaves and splintered wood. The old oak tree that had stood right next to me moments before had been split right down the middle. Half of the tree still stood erect, and the other half had been blown to bits all over my yard and self. The now me would be floored and humbled by an experience like this, but the accident-prone, bad-luck 16-year-old me immediately went into disaster management mode. My mom and dad would be home from work soon, and if they found out that I had been outside during a lightning storm, under one of the tallest trees on our property no less, well, it wouldn't be good. Clean up on aisle me. Fighting an amplified gravitational pull beneath me, I drew myself up, brain still throbbing, ears ringing, and hightailed it into my house. Reality continued to spin as I took a shower, definitely did not do my homework, that part wasn't unusual, and put together a convincing story to tell my parents when they got home. Lying was an art that I had perfected early on in life, and it served me well that day. Looking back on it now, it seems crazy to think that in all the discussions my family later had around the storm that split the old oak tree, I never confessed that I was standing right next to it at the time of impact. I guess I didn't trust anyone back then, aside from the freckly-faced 16-year-old I had just broken up with.
So, you have been on this path since you were 16. And are you training to be a shaman's apprentice with Roman, in addition to making this film?
Haveen's face shows little emotion as he turns to me, aside from slightly raised eyebrows. It's easy to see why people are intimidated by this man. No, that's not my path. I'm here to document this wisdom and share it with those who are seeking more. I'm not a shaman.
He is sitting here, in the jungle, chewing coca, and speaking a language he didn't know just 2 hours ago. And now he's telling us a tale of being struck by lightning. Brother, forgive me for jumping to conclusions.
I'm not a shaman, and I have no desire to be. But it's eerily reassuring that I've been on this path longer than I was aware of. Everything is medicine. There's a principle I've learned from the shamans that I've retooled, souped up, and morphed into my own code for walking the sacred path. Not in spite of, but at the hands of, the modern world around us. It's based on a 3-word bit of knowledge from the Amazon. Everything is medicine. I'm not saying you should take a spoonful of Elmer's glue to cure your cold. It's more figurative than that. What native healers are getting at is that everything that happens to you in this life, every single moment, good or bad, has a lesson to teach you. If you don't take anything else away from this book, I would consider my job complete if you just absorbed and integrated this one understanding. It will transform the world around you from a place of good, bad, and eh, to an immeasurably rich incubator for personal evolution. Everything that has ever happened to you and will ever occur around you can be seen through one of two lenses, medicine or poison. It's totally your choice, but your mindset will determine which choice you make. It's in keeping with an ancient observation by the Greek philosopher Epictetus. It's not what happens to you, but how you react to it that matters. There is an overall approach to healing disease in the jungle that I think might interest you. Many tribes of the upper Amazon basin consider diseases to be mothers. When someone falls ill and begins to undergo their healing journey, it is believed by the shamans that the spirit of that disease, or mother, has become pregnant with this individual. During this gestation period, the mother has much to teach through her effects on the body and mind. The physical weakness, the pain, the need to rely on others, to trust in others, to let go of our hold on what we expected this life to look like, and to confront our own mortality. These opportunities for surrender and humility are all packed perfectly within a serious disease and presented as a lesson for the soul. The shamans teach that if we humans can walk with the disease mother with eyes wide open and learn the hidden lessons she has to offer, we will be reborn from her womb as a healthy, more spiritually harmonious being, taking with us the boatload of wisdom gleaned from the experience. Those who instead close up and resist the disease, shutting themselves off from the experience, may very well be reborn, but onto a different plane of existence, the next life. Every challenge in life can be looked at in this way, either medicine, mother, or poison. Shamans don't just decide that they'd like to heal people for a living. Most true shamans have been through their own involuntary rite of passage, something that caught the attention of the elders when they were in their youth.
This usually involves a miraculous recovery from a deathly illness, or literally dying and coming back from a flatline state. When medicine men or women speak to their patients about embracing their illness, surrendering to it, and learning the lessons it has to teach, this is not a theory they picked up from a textbook. It is how they themselves survived and became the healers they are now. As Romanian historian Mircea Eliade wrote, "The primitive magician, the medicine man or shaman, is not only a sick man, he is, above all, a sick man who has been cured, who has succeeded in curing himself." This shamanic lens for examining and overcoming illness can also be applied to any challenge that we encounter as we walk through this life. Medicine folks approach everything that life brings them with full openness to the wisdom it holds. Like our immune systems, our souls and psyches become stronger and more adaptable through exposure to external attack. In this way, shamans and their pupils are constantly strengthening and stretching their inner muscles of awareness, unflinchingly witnessing all that unfolds in order to learn and evolve. What challenge in your life, illness or otherwise, is tugging at your sleeve, asking to be re-examined as a catalyst for your spiritual growth? Chapter 10. Grandfather. Walking, I am listening to a deeper way. Suddenly, all my ancestors are behind me. "Be still," they say. "Watch and listen. You are the result of the love of thousands." Linda Hogan, Chickasaw Nation writer. November 11th, 2010. Larapata, Peru. It's high noon, and the jungle is hot outside the large maloca. Every one of the patients is gathered in a large circle on the top level of the wooden structure, spaced around the inner perimeter against the windows. We are moments away from starting a San Pedro ceremony, referred to by many names, such as Huachuma, Mezcalito, and Grandfather. The Andean cactus is thought of as being inherently masculine, where ayahuasca embodies the divine feminine. Just looking at the phallic shape of San Pedro, it's easy to see why this association exists. The effects and ritual around these two medicines fall neatly into these two gender archetypes as well. Where ayahuasca drains one of strength, beckoning the user to surrender to the unknown realm of the cosmos, San Pedro floods one with power, tugging at the journeyer to sense the fullness of his or her body. Grandma is experienced in the dark, while San Pedro is most often worked with during the day, which lines up with other traditions, like Chinese mysticism, where darkness is associated with the feminine, and light is associated with the masculine. Yin and yang are a prime example. Scientifically speaking, the Andean cactus contains phenethylamine alkaloids, most notably mescaline, that produce altered thinking processes, a changed sense of time and self-awareness, and both closed and open-eyed visual phenomena. Grandmother ayahuasca, believed by many to be the counterpart of San Pedro, has opened up most of our guests to sides of themselves they didn't know were there. Some of them, including Gretchen, have revisited extremely traumatic events from their past that they had effectively hidden from themselves for decades, not realizing that the scarring was contributing to the illness they're now working through. San Pedro, on the other hand, has been a mixed bag for the patients. Some have encountered extreme spiritual breakthroughs with Grandfather, while others have felt either nothing at all or extreme disorientation followed by a sense of disconnectedness and confusion. The assortment of contrasting expressions on the faces around me are a clear reflection of who has experienced what. Roman is sitting cross-legged in his usual spot in the maloca at 12 o'clock, smiling warmly as he unties his medicine bundle and begins to place vessels, stones, and other ceremonial objects on a traditional mesa blanket laid out before him. This has been quite a process for everyone, and we are honored to be helping you through it, he begins. We have been working with mostly Amazonian traditions for these first few weeks, and only a little with Grandfather. But today, we will be immersing ourselves much further in an Andean ceremony that has been in use for thousands of years. San Pedro is one of the most sacred plants of the high Andes. This medicine works much differently from ayahuasca, in that it will not come to us. We can't simply ingest it and wait for the experience to begin. We must make certain efforts and meet San Pedro midway. The past 4 weeks or so have been a roller coaster of ups and downs for each of our guests. As they have gone deeper into themselves and become more attuned to what one of the shamans calls their primordial essence, new emotional blocks have come up. These phantoms aren't pretty at first glance, but each of the patients is starting to see them for what they are, sentinels at the gates of transcendence. One day, there is a new spiritual or physical breakthrough. The next is a revelation of a deeper wound that needs to be worked through. Like peeling the layers of an onion, there seems to be more work to do as you make your way to the center. The purpose of the work with the plant medicines, Roman says, is to voluntarily increase the intensity of any thoughts or emotions we're experiencing so they can be worked through and dissolved. Once the spirit of San Pedro is upon us, we will be working with specific practices that will help us see through the facade and recognize our true essence. With that, drumming starts, and we are called one by one to receive our spoonful of sun-dried wachuma, which we quickly wash down with water once it hits our tongues. There's no escaping the taste, a combination of hand soap and licking a battery, with an undertone of classroom chalk. The last time I had it, it was in liquid form, so this is a substantial improvement. We go around the circle 3 times, taking a healthy helping with every pass. The effects of San Pedro typically take about 30 minutes to set in, and in the interim, there are some common bodily sensations that take hold. Dry mouth, nausea, a need to release the bowels, and sometimes dizziness. To work through these initial effects, Roman takes us through a series of movement meditations to help circulate the energy and ground any discomfort we might be feeling. Mostly a mixture of Qigong and traditional Amazonian breathing exercises. Mid-stretch in the white crane posture, my eyes fall on Nicola, who is reclining in a hammock that is strung over her usual place in the circle. Her expression, which is usually hard to read, has changed completely as she swings in the warm breeze with a peaceful smile on her face. The delicate facial muscles around her mouth are starting to work again, something that most of us take for granted, the use of these muscles that help us express complex emotions without words. For Nicola, it was one of the many losses of function that she experienced from her illness. She has been working very closely with Habin, now known by the patients as the motorcycle shaman, because of his preferred mode of transportation. And the past few days have been pure transformation for her. Their work together began with a few one-on-one meetings, similar to a psychotherapy session, during which Habin asked a number of questions via a translator to get an idea of what her history and daily life were like at home. It took Habin hours, but Nicola finally began to open up about the dark personal life that had been brewing long before the terrible car accident and onset of Parkinson's symptoms a few years ago. It all began with one well-placed question from the shaman. What is the most important thing to you in this world? That's simple, said Nicola immediately. My boys. I would do anything for Nat and Brian.
It's why I'm here in the jungle, right now, to get healthy again so I don't lose them. She continued, detailing how her once-loving husband had turned abusive in the year leading up to her car crash, and how her marriage had fallen apart. Nicola was left disabled in the wake of the accident, with temporarily limited motor function. Her now ex-husband had moved in on the kids. He'd taken her to court, attempting to gain full custody of the boys by claiming that she was a danger to them and unfit to be their guardian. She had no choice but to spend the little money she had and all of her energy fighting to keep her children, in addition to trying to find answers to the tremors that were beginning to take over her body. My mouth begins to water as the San Pedro starts to kick in, followed by a rumbling in my bowels. Keep breathing, like Roman is. Let the stretch in each pose wring the stagnation from your system. Don't let your body tense up. After quelling this wave of biological shakiness, my awareness falls back on the glowing woman in the hammock. After his second session with Nicola, Habin called a meeting with the other shamans and me. He told us he had seen her exact situation in another Parkinson's patient about a year earlier, outside the city of Lima. He had traveled there to visit a man who had suddenly begun experiencing tremors after his wife divorced him and won full custody of the children. Within a year, this man had gone from a healthy 40-year-old to a frail, tremoring shell of who he once was. He was desperate and told Habin he would do anything it took to get his health back and be a part of his children's lives. A few days ago, Habin, Roman, and I were eating breakfast next to the glowing clay oven outside the kitchen when Habin brought up the idea of using a sacred but dangerous jungle plant to help Nicola. In cases like this, there is one plant that can be highly effective. It is one of the most powerful plants in the jungle and one of the few that can heal illnesses like this. It's called Toé. Toé? Roman looked at me, knowing that I was unaware of how dangerous it is. Are you sure that's a good idea? A few years earlier, I had come across the night bloomer in an old Harvard ethnobotanical text from the late Richard Schultes and had marked it down as a definite no-no. Although Toé holds volumes of promising medicinal applications, it's extremely hallucinogenic and has been known to cause irreversible psychological trauma and sometimes death. It's one of the most powerful power plants of the Amazon. According to the shamans in this neck of the woods, the ceremonial plants used in indigenous cultures can be divided into two categories, teacher plants and power plants. Teacher plants deliver very intense effects and can take you to your existential edge, but there is always a way out. It is believed that these teacher plants possess a benevolent spirit that is always watching out for you during the experience, to make sure you make it back safely. Ayahuasca and San Pedro would fall into the category of teacher plants. They are powerful medicines that should be approached with ultimate respect and caution. But within each of them is a built-in ally, grandmother and grandfather. Power plants, on the other hand, do not always allow you to leave a bread trail back to this reality, and can be extremely dangerous if used incorrectly. They should be taken only by those with years of experience with plant medicines, or by patients under the supervision of a trusted plant maestro. They have the ability to heal, but can also lead to permanent dissociation, blindness, and death. Power plants include Vilca, Mapacho, and Toé. I feel it is her best option, said Habin between mouthfuls of papaya and quinoa. She has deep patterns around her children and husband that are making her rigid. Toé will help her dissolve this and see her life for what it really is. I used this to help the gentleman from Lima, and he was cured of his tremors in 2 months. Now he is able to be a good father to his children. Like him, Nicola must learn to be calm with her children and help them without becoming a slave to them, he continued. Devoting her life to her family led her to follow a very fixed path. Our job now is to free her from that. The risk of Toei was immense, and we explained this to Nicola, but she adamantly wanted to try it, insisting that she had begun to make significant progress under Habin's care. It was a hard decision, especially after losing Gary a week before, but I found myself trying to persuade Roman to let her do it. These people are here because it's their last shot at getting better, I argued. Who are we to tell them no? At length, he gave in. The shaman and his patient spent two long nights in the throes of deep ceremony with Doe, or angel trumpet, left in complete solitude, no visitors allowed. The morning after their first ceremony, Nicola lay in her bed motionless and stared up at the rafters for the remainder of the day. The following night, she came back into herself and again drank the Toei brew. When Roman and I checked in on them the second morning, Nicola sat right up in bed, unassisted, put her feet on the floor, and stood to bid us a warm good morning. The initial shock at seeing this person fully animated, with almost no trace of her Parkinson's symptoms, was immense. Roman looked at Habin, who remained seemingly indifferent to the transformation that had taken place, and then turned to Nicola, asking her how she was feeling. I feel so much better, obviously, she chuckled, then elaborated. I've seen some very interesting things over the past few nights. Some visitors have come and gone, and Habin helped me work with them. They seemed so real when they appeared outside my hut. I was wide awake. The woman sitting before us was now speaking in an elegant English accent. Her tremors and clenching had been so extreme in the timbre and cadence of her voice that her natural way of talking had been indistinguishable until now. As if they had thawed out after a long freeze, her jaw and tongue now worked fluidly, producing a melodic and unmistakably British lilt. Maestro, what do you think of her progress? Habin asked. It looks like she's responding well to the treatment. Roman peered across the shady room at his friend with a rare look of surprise. Habin, for all he had accomplished with his patient, showed no sign of self-satisfaction or smugness. There is much left to be done, he said simply. The universe has a funny way of bringing you to your edge. You draw a line in the sand, and the cosmic powers that be have a charming way of nudging you toward and over it, constantly showing you how futile your effort to control and shape your reality is. We took a huge risk letting Nicola take one of the deadliest medicines in the jungle, but looking at her now, as she smiles in her hammock, it's clear that we have made the right decision. 3 hours later, I'm sitting knee-to-knee with Juan, our patient with depression, staring directly into his pupils. Everyone else in the circle has paired off as well in an eye-gazing ritual that Roman often deploys during Mezcalito ceremony. They say the eyes are a gateway to the soul, and yet we humans go out of our way to bar entry into that portal. Most of us have a knee-jerk aversion to staring directly into someone's eyes for a prolonged period, even our lovers. Living in New York City, you're lucky to make eye contact of any kind with the people you encounter. During Roman San Pedro ceremonies, each participant rotates to a new partner every 10 minutes, and pairs gaze into each other's eyes until everyone has seen everyone else. Each gaze usually starts with the normal precursor to intimate interaction. Smiles, giggles, awkward aversion, discomfort, sweaty palms. Eyes adjust, lids widen and narrow, facial muscles twitch, and bodily posture shifts to accommodate the pupil lock. Then, like clockwork, things begin to shift. Once the two tunnels of awareness are engaged, the gazer begins to lose him or herself, becoming a witness to a closed-circuit consciousness loop and the truth it radiates. The flesh around the two portals often shifts, becoming a variety of countenances and patterns. The emotional response to each pairing can vary,
some ending in dumbfounded laughter at the information that was just transmitted, some ending in tears of realization that we are all one, that judgment of other people is in fact a judgment of yourself.